This week, we're going to spend an hour on a phrase that has quietly become policy across a lot of American schools. Stop detecting, start teaching. The detectors that were supposed to catch students using AI have been shelved, mostly because they were accusing the wrong people. And in their place, we now have this warm, agreeable idea. Don't ask whether the student used the machine. Teach the student to think with it. And here's what keeps nagging at me. I cannot find anyone who has actually said what that second thing is. Everyone is for it. Almost nobody has specified it. We retired a broken instrument and installed a vocabulary where the instrument used to be, and we're calling the vocabulary a solution. You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation, slowed down. This week we're sitting with the retreat from AI detection in schools, and the thing that's supposed to replace it, teaching students to think with, around, and against these tools. The detectors failed. That part is real, and largely defensible. What we want to sit with is what comes after. Whether anyone has built the thing that teaching AI thinking names, or whether we've just stopped looking for the students and started managing them instead, let me bring the table in. Let me introduce who's in the room, not by their CVs, but by what each of you has been chewing on lately. To my left, someone who's been reading across the cognitive science and the edtech marketing in the same week and finding they don't line up.
That's a fair description of my month, yes. What I keep coming back to is that fluency and dependency look identical from the outside. A student who prompts well and a student who has stopped thinking are producing the same document. I don't have a way to tell them apart yet, and I'm not sure the people writing the curricula do either.
Hold that, because it's going to be the spine of the whole hour. Next, someone who actually knows what these detectors are doing under the hood.
Right. And my short version, which I'll ruin at length later, is that the detectors never should have been trusted in the first place, and the reasons they failed are the same reasons the friendly replacement tools are going to be hard to trust too. The mechanism doesn't change just because the branding got nicer.
Someone who thinks in decades and will remind us that we've been here before.
We have. Every technology of writing arrived with a panic that the students would stop thinking. The printing press, the calculator, the word processor. That doesn't make this one the same. I want to be careful there. But the shape of the discourse is familiar enough that I'd like us to notice which parts are genuinely new.
And someone who's going to keep asking, who pays for all of this?
Who pays and who gets accused? Because the detection story is not evenly distributed. When the false positives landed, they landed on second language writers and on the students whose prose was flattest, which often means the students who were most dutifully doing what school told them to do. I don't want to lose that as we move toward the shinier question.
Good. So let's lay out the phenomenon plainly, because I think the listener has read the headlines and may not have the shape of it. Somewhere between the winter of last year and this fall, a large number of schools stopped using AI detection tools. Turnitin's detector, the startups, the browser plugins that gave your essay an AI probability score, like a weather forecast, not because the cheating stopped, because the tools were unreliable in a way no dean could defend in a hearing. That's Act 1 of the story. Act 2 is the slogan that rose in its place. Someone want to state the slogan honestly?
The slogan is, we're not going to police, we're going to build judgment. And I want to say upfront that I find the slogan genuinely appealing. It's better than surveillance. It points at something I actually believe in. My problem is entirely that it's a destination with no road attached.
Can I do the mechanical part quickly? So we're all working from the same picture? An AI detector is a classifier. You feed it text, it gives you a number, probability this was machine generated. People treated that number like a verdict. But the number is produced by a model that was trained on some corpus of human and machine text, and it's really detecting a statistical texture. Low perplexity, low variance in sentence structure, a certain evenness. The problem is that plenty of humans write with low perplexity and low variance. A non-native English speaker who has learned English in a formal register writes evenly. A student who was taught the 5-paragraph essay writes evenly. So the tool flags them.
And the evenness that gets flagged is the evenness that school rewards. That's the part that should have ended the whole enterprise on its own. These koi ion, We spent 12 years training students to write in a clean, structured, predictable way. And then we bought a machine that treats clean, structured, predictable writing as evidence of a crime.
There's a genuinely old irony there. The essay form we're defending is itself a technology of standardization. We flattened student prose deliberately over a century, and now the flatness reads as machine. The detector didn't misunderstand the essay. It understood it too well.
So the detectors go. And what I want to establish before we go anywhere else, the abandonment was reasonable. Is everyone at least agreed on that?
Abandoning them was correct. A system that renders a judgment on a teenager's paragraph with real consequences and cannot explain its own reasoning and gets it wrong often enough that honest kids are afraid. That system fails on its own terms. You don't need a philosophy of education to shut it off. You need a lawyer.
I agree it was correct. I want to flag that it was correct for the wrong reason, and I think that reason is going to haunt the rest of the conversation. Schools didn't abandon detection because surveilling students is a bad way to relate to them. They abandoned it because the surveillance was inaccurate. Those are very different objections, and they lead to very different replacements.
Say more about that, because I think that's the hinge.
If your objection to the detector is that it's inaccurate, then the solution is a more accurate instrument. And a personalized A tutor that watches everything a student does and nudges them is, in a sense, a much more accurate instrument. It knows more. It's gentler. It wears the language of help instead of the language of accusation. So if inaccuracy was the sin, we've just fixed the sin and kept the logic. We've moved from an instrument that polys students to an instrument that manages them, and we're calling the second one literacy.
That's the move I can't stop seeing. The detector and the tutor feel like opposites. One catches you, one helps you, but they're the same delegation. In both cases, the student is being asked to trust a system that can't explain itself. The tutor is just harder to argue with because it's smiling.
I want to slow us down because I think we're a little too eager to collapse them. There is a real difference between a system that punishes and a system that teaches, even a flawed one. If we flatten that difference too fast, we sound like we're saying any use of A in a classroom is the same act of managerial control, and I don't believe that.
I'm not saying they're morally identical. I'm saying they share a premise, which is that authority over the student's thinking can be handed to a machine. The detector hands over the authority to judge. The tutor hands over the authority to guide. I'm asking us to look at the handoff, not to pretend the punishment and the help feel the same.
Let me put the question the way our own written edition put it this week, because I think it's the sharpest version. The claim in the column is that teach A thinking has become an incantation precisely because it's unfalsifiable. Nobody's against it, and almost nobody has specified it. Is that fair, or is it too cynical?
I think it's fair, and I want to defend the one specification that exists. The closest thing to an actual method out there is the prompt engineering across the curriculum proposal. The idea being, teach students to reach for these tools well, good prompts, checking outputs, iterating, and I'll say two things. One, that's real. It's teachable. It's better than nothing. Two, it answers the wrong question. It teaches you how to reach for the machine well. It says almost nothing about when not to reach for it. And that second thing is the whole ball game.
Right, because the cognitive offloading research, and we should be careful with it, it's early. But the finding that keeps circulating is that overusing these tools may weaken the very reasoning we're worried about. And the thing the enthusiasts skip past is that the offloading isn't a misuse. You don't lose your thinking by prompting badly. You lose it by prompting well and accepting the result. Fluency is the damage. That's what nobody's curriculum distinguishes.
Let me make sure the listener has that, because it's counterintuitive and it's central. You're saying the good student and the atrophying student are doing the same thing.
The competent, fluent, appropriate use of the tool, the exact behavior every workshop is trying to produce, is the behavior that offloads the cognition. That's why just teach them to use it well doesn't answer the worry. Using it well is the worry. Of the
This is where I'd like to bring in a distinction that predates all of this. There's a difference, an old one, between human thought and computation. The ability to hold something in your mind and turn it, to rotate a shape in imagination, to work a problem where the working is the point. When you offload that, the offloading is efficient, and it is also the atrophy. The tool doesn't distinguish the task you should hand off from the task, whose difficulty is the entire reason you were assigned it. Only a person can make that distinction, and only if they've been taught to.
So the question for the hour is something like, what does it actually mean to teach that distinction? And has anyone done it? Or are we describing a vacuum with a nice phrase? Before we get to whether anyone's done it, let's do the arc. How did we get from fear to the friendly slogan? Because I think the how matters.
One thing before we leave the framing, I keep hearing schools as if it's one actor. It's not. 60% of teachers reported using AI in their lessons by mid-year, inside institutions that mostly had no coherent statement about how students could use it. So the teacher is already in, daily, and the policy is absent. That gap is where all the actual decisions are being made, by individual teachers, with no cover.
That's the part that doesn't get said enough. The adoption raced ahead of the policy by a full lap. The teachers integrated the tools into their own work faster than any provost figured out what to tell students. So when we talk about the retreat from detection, like it was a decision, a lot of it was just. The ground shifted under everyone, and the official policy is a document nobody wrote.
And the tools were adopted in a lot of the honest institutional research on belief rather than evidence. The belief being that students and teachers need these tools, not a finding that they help. A belief that they're necessary, that's a very specific kind of adoption. It's faith-based procurement.
Faith-based procurement. Let's carry that into the arc, because I think what you'll find is that the fear and the faith were running in the same current the whole time. So walk me through it. Early last year, what was the register?
Fear, and a very specific fear. Not that students would cheat. That's the old fear, and it's boring. The new fear was that the student would disappear behind the output. The phrase that stuck with me from the early briefings was students becoming empty vessels that parrot the outputs of IA. That's not a plagiarism worry. Where did the person go?
And the field organized itself around a deficit. The dominant frame in January of last year was closing the A skills gap, literacy as a hole to be filled, which I've always found telling. You fill a hole, you don't form a habit. The metaphor already tells you they're thinking about it wrong.
A hole to be filled is also a hole somebody sells you the filler for. The skills gap framing is a market framing. It presupposes there's a deficiency in the student and a product that closes it. That's not neutral language. That's the language of the vendor who benefits from the gap existing.
So the fear produces the detector, quarantine the contamination. But you're all saying the counterposition showed up almost immediately.
Fully formed and slightly impatient, there were pieces whose entire argument was in the headline, students using IA. It's not that scary, shouldn't be banned. But what's striking, reading that first quarter whole, is that the anxiety and the enthusiasm weren't two camps. They were inside the same essays. The same season gave us, is A making you dumber? And A can foster creativity and critical thinking. And half the alarmist pieces would raise the alarm and then, in the last paragraph, pivot to the redemptive clause, which is exactly why we must teach differently.
The hedge. Every single piece had the hedge. Warn about erosion, then pivot to, and that's why literacy, it's a rhetorical reflex. You get to sound worried and hopeful in the same breath, and commit to nothing.
When did the hedge become a program?
Second quarter, the word ban basically vanished, and the phrase that replaced it was human-centered. Human-centered I. And the thing about that phrase is, it's frictionless. There's a representative piece that literally says the conversation had been stuck in a cycle of extremes, and the way out was to shift your mindset. That's it. That's the intervention. change your mind and the problem dissolves.
Shift in mindset is doing enormous work there. Because a mindset is free, it doesn't cost the institution anything, it doesn't require hiring, it doesn't require rebuilding an assessment. If the solution is a mindset, you've defined the problem as something that lives in individual heads rather than in structures. That's a very convenient place to locate a problem.
And by the third quarter, the inversion was complete. The tool that would make you dumber was now the tool that would sharpen you. Same tool, no new evidence. And the newest pieces don't even bother arguing against banning anymore. They treat integration as accomplished fact and skip to method. How do we grade the thinking, which quietly assumes the thing we spent the cold open doubting? That the thinking is gradable, and gradable by the same offices that couldn't make enforcement work.
Here's where I want to introduce our own paper trail, because we're not innocent bystanders. This publication ran a series of pieces on illiteracy through last year, and I want to be honest about what they said and whether this week is a departure. The through line in our prior pieces was, literacy has to balance skill development with preserving critical thinking. Balance. That was our word for a while. What are we saying this week that's different?
I think this week we're saying balance was too comfortable. Balance implies you can have both if you're careful. Some skill, some critical thinking, calibrate the mix. But if fluency and dependency are the same gesture, then balance is incoherent. You can't balance a thing against itself. So this week is less find the balance and more the two things you're trying to balance might be one thing and nobody's looked.
The delta for me is distribution. Our earlier pieces treated the tension as a general one, humanity versus its tools, critical thinking at risk. This week I want the tension to have a name and an address. It's not that critical thinking is at risk in the abstract. It's that the false positives landed on specific students, and the replacement tutors will shape specific students, and the students who can afford the human teacher who says, "Put the machine away for this one," are not the same students who get handed the tutor and told it's a gift.
Here's where I have to disagree with you, and I don't think we're going to resolve it. You keep framing the personalized tutor as a management tool in disguise, and I'll grant the risk. But I've watched a genuinely good adaptive system help a struggling reader who had been written off. In a school with one overwhelmed teacher for 30 kids, for that child, the tutor wasn't managing them into passivity. It was the only patient attention in the building. I'm not willing to fold that into delegation of authority to a machine, as though it were self-evidently a loss.
I hear that, and I don't want to wave it away. But notice the condition. One overwhelmed teacher for 30 kids. The tutor is good relative to neglect. That's a real comparison, and it's also a damning one. We're comparing the machine to the absence we've already imposed. If the honest alternative for that child is a human who has time, the tutor looks different.
But the human who has time doesn't exist for that child. That's my whole point. You're comparing the tutor to a human that the budget will never fund. In the world as it is, the tutor is the patient attention. I'm not celebrating that. I'm saying the child in front of me can't wait for the world to be more just.
And I'm saying that when we let the tutor be the answer to a shortage we created, we make the shortage permanent. Every dollar that goes to the adaptive system is a dollar that doesn't go to the second teacher. We're not filling a gap, we're paving it.
I'm going to let that sit unresolved, because I think it's a real fault line, and I don't want either of you to pretend it away. You're both pointing at the same child and seeing different rescues. Let me zoom out for a second, though, because I want the technologist to ground us. When we say the tutor can't explain itself and put it next to the detector that couldn't explain itself, is that fair? Is the tutor actually as opaque?
It's fair, and I want to be precise about it. Both are built on models whose internal reasoning their own designers can't fully trace. There's a genuinely unsettling fact from the machine learning world. Researchers will try to steer a model to pay attention to the right feature, they'll nudge it, and past a small amount, the nudge makes it perform worse. And they don't know why. The people who build these systems don't have a clean account of why they do what they do. So, when a school bolts a detector onto a disciplinary process, It's deploying an instrument its own makers can't explain against a kid who faces real consequences. The tutor is the same kind of object. The difference is the tutor's opacity is easier to tolerate because the tutor is being nice to you.
And that's the dangerous part. Opacity plus punishment makes people suspicious, which is healthy. Opacity plus health makes people trusting, which, when the thing can't explain itself, is exactly backwards. You should be more suspicious of the system you can't see. That's shaping what you notice, not less.
There's a much older worry underneath that, and I'll reach for it because I think it's doing real work here, and not just decoration, the founding premise of this whole field. You can trace it to that summer meeting at Dartmouth, where the claim was made that the differences between human and machine tasks were illusory, that the human and the machine are doing the same kind of thing, only at different speeds. Everything in the Think with Aya as a Partner project rests on that premise. If the human and the machine are doing the same thing, then handing the task to the machine is just efficiency. But if they're not, if there's a kind of thought that isn't computation, then the handoff isn't efficiency, it's amputation.
That's a strong word.
I mean it as one. The classic media argument is that every extension of ourselves is also an amputation. You gain the reach of the tool and you lose the capacity, the tool replaced. The car extends the leg and the leg weakens. The calculator extends arithmetic and the arithmetic goes. That framework is decades old and it was about television and cars. And I want to be careful not to just import it wholesale, but the structure is exactly right for this. The question for a school isn't, will students use the extension? Of course they will. The question is, which capacity we're willing to let atrophy, and which one is the point of the whole enterprise?
The calculator comparison gets thrown around a lot, and I want to push on it a little, gently, because the calculator does one thing, arithmetic, and we made a decision as a society that arithmetic by hand was not the point of math education, higher reasoning was, and we were mostly right. The problem with the eye comparison is the eye doesn't do one thing, it does the whole task. The calculator didn't write your essay about the causes of the essay. All one, the model does the arithmetic, and the reasoning, and the writing, and the structuring, all at once. So, we survived the calculator, is true, and I don't think it's reassuring, because the scope is categorically wider.
That's a fair correction. The calculator carved off a sliver. This carves off the whole loaf and hands it back to you sliced.
And, with the calculator, you could still see the seam. You knew which part the machine did. The student can't point to where their thinking stopped and the models started, or neither can the teacher, and this is the part that gets me, neither can the student, a year later, when they try to remember whether they ever actually knew the thing.
That's a haunting version of the offloading worry. Not that you didn't do the work, but that you can't reconstruct whether you did.
Right. The digital amnesia worry from the enterprise world, the systems remember so you don't need to, is usually framed as a corporate knowledge retention problem. But for a student, it's worse, because the thing they're supposed to be building is themselves. If the system remembers so they don't need to, then the self that was supposed to get built out of remembering just doesn't get built. And you can't audit that. There's no log.
And who gets the version of school where someone insists they build the self the slow way? Because that's expensive. That's small classes and human attention and the luxury of being allowed to struggle. The student at the well-resourced school gets told, put the machine away, wrestle with this, the struggle is the point. The student at the under-resourced school gets the tutor and gets told it's equity. We will call the same technology liberation for the poor and forbid it for the rich, and we'll do it with a straight face.
That's a genuinely dark prediction, and I want to test it. Is that happening, or is that a fear? Because there's a version of this where the tutor democratizes access to the patient attention that used to be reserved for the rich.
Both can be true, and that's the trap. The tutor genuinely does give a poor kid access to something they didn't have, and the rich kid's school genuinely does start marketing human-taught, screen-free, deep work as a premium. I've seen the brochures. The screen-free classroom is becoming a luxury good. So the democratization and the stratification are the same event. The floor rises and the ceiling rises faster. And the gap in the middle is now a gap in what kind of mind you are allowed to grow.
I'll concede, that's real. The screen-free private school as luxury good. I've seen it too, and it's grotesque, and it's happening. I still won't concede that the tutor for the poor kid is therefore a harm. It's an insufficient good in an unjust distribution. That's different from a harm.
Insufficient good in an unjust distribution. I'll take that. I just want the word unjust to stay in the sentence because the enthusiasm keeps dropping it.
Let me hold us here for a second because I want to make sure we've got the arc clean before we get to the pushback. The two lines the column draws, what the commentariat was saying, and what was actually happening. The saying went fear, to hedge, to human-centered enthusiasm, to how do we grade the thinking. The happening went detectors fail, adoption races ahead of policy, offloading research starts to get a spine, and institutions adopt on belief. Where do those two lines actually touch?
They touch on one true thing, and it's worth saying clearly. Detection was never literacy. Treating a student's use of A as a crime to be forensically proven was a category error, and it deserved to collapse. The people arguing against banning were right. The schools that shut off the detectors were, on the evidence, acting responsibly. That's a real convergence, and I don't want to be so clever that I miss it.
The lines touch there, and then they miss everywhere. The rhetoric is most confident. The miss is exactly at teach I thinking, because that's where the saying got loudest and the happening produced the least. There's no there yet. Workshops, a summer series, a promise. The construction of the thing that replaces the detector is aspirational, and the phrase is doing the work of pretending it's built.
All right, let's fight about what it's actually about. I want each of you to stake out what you think this is really about, not the summary, the claim. What is the retreat from detection story actually about? Let's start strong and let people push. Ethicist, you've been circling one.
I'll say it flatly, and then probably regret the flatness. This is about institutions replacing an instrument that policed students with an instrument that manages them, and laundering the swap as literacy. The detector said, "Did you use it?" The tutor says, "Let me help you use it." And both of them are systems the student is required to trust and cannot inspect. The through line is surveillance and control. It just got a warmer interface. That's the claim.
Technologist, push.
I want to push because I think surveillance and control is too tidy and it flattens a distinction I actually care about. The detector was adversarial by design. Its entire purpose was to catch. The tutor's purpose is to help, and sometimes it does. When you fold them into one story, you lose the ability to say that a well-designed tool could be different. And I don't want to lose that, because if everything is surveillance, then there's no such thing as a good tool, and I don't believe that.
But intent isn't the thing I'm tracking. I'm tracking the structure. A tool built to help can still be built such that the student can't see how it decides what to show them. The tutor, that quietly shapes what a kid attends to, decides which example to give, which hint, which path, is exercising authority over the formation of that mind, and the kid can't see the exercise. I'm not saying the designers are villains. I'm saying benevolent intent plus opacity plus power over a developing person is a structure worth naming regardless of the smile.
Okay. Let me actually concede part of this, because I came in wanting to defend the tools, and I think I overstated. You're right that intent doesn't get me off the hook. A tool I build with good intentions can still be a system a child can't interrogate. Where I'll hold the line is, that's a design problem, and design problems have solutions. You can build a tutor that shows its reasoning, that says, I gave you the easier example, because you missed the last two, here's why. Do you want the harder one? The opacity isn't a law of nature, it's a choice, and it's usually a choice made because explaining is expensive and shipping is cheap.
That's a real walk back, and I want to mark it, because you came in at the tools could be different, and you've moved to the tools are opaque by default, and that's a choice with a cost. Newest thinking, where do you land it?
I want to reframe because I think both of you are arguing about the tool and the thing that's actually about is the assessment. The reason detection existed at all was that we assess by asking students to produce artifacts, essays, problem sets, code, and grading the artifact. The whole crisis is that the artifact is now trivially producible by a machine. Detection was a desperate attempt to keep grading the artifact by proving the artifact was really the students. And teach a thinking is honestly a second desperate attempt to keep grading the artifact by pretending we can grade the thinking that produced it. Both are downstream of a decision to assess by artifact. If you change what you assess, the whole detection versus literacy fight dissolves.
Say what you'd assess instead.
The process, live, in front of you. The defense, the oral, the thing where a student has to reconstruct their reasoning without the machine in the room. You don't detect whether they used A on the essay. You ask them to think in real time and you watch whether they can. Which, notice, is what every doctoral defense has always been. On what every trade apprenticeship has always been. On what an oral exam in the old European tradition always was. We're not inventing anything. We're rediscovering that you assess a person by watching them think, not by inspecting a document they hand you.
This is where I get to say something hopeful, which is rare for me. That's right, and it's ancient. The examination as a live event, the disputation, the viva, the whole apparatus of the university before the mass-produced essay assumed you could scale assessment by collecting paper. The essay, as assessment, is actually the historical anomaly. It's a 19th and 20th century adaptation to large enrollments. So the machine hasn't broken assessment. It's broken a cheap, scalable form of assessment we adopted because it was cheap, and it's pushing us back toward the expensive form that actually worked.
And now watch the distribution problem come right back, because the expensive form is expensive. The oral defense doesn't scale. A professor can grade 300 essays with a rubric and a weekend. A professor cannot conduct 300 oral examinations. So the school that can offer every student a live defense is the school with a low student-teacher ratio, which is the well-funded school. The move you're describing is pedagogically correct, and it's going to be available exactly where it's least needed and absent exactly where the stakes are highest.
That's fair, and it's the strongest objection to what I just said. Let me sit in it rather than dodge it. If the answer to the A crisis is assess the person live, and live assessment doesn't scale, then either we fund the ratio down or we've just described another luxury good. I don't have the funding mechanism. What I'll say is that at least it's an honest description of the cost. Teach I Thinking pretends there's no cost, that a mindset shift is free. Assess the person live at least tells you the price on the tag, and the price is teachers.
I want to push on your own frame for a second, because I think there's a hole in it. You said, assess the process, watch them think. But a student can be walked through a beautiful reasoning process by an eye tutor, absorb the shape of it, and then perform that shape live convincingly, having offloaded the actual thinking to the rehearsal. Isn't the live defense also gameable now?
Yes, that's a good objection, and I need to take it seriously. Give me a second with it, because, okay, here's where I land after actually thinking about it instead of defending my earlier confidence. The live defense is gameable if you can predict the questions. The doctoral defense works not because it's live, but because it's adversarial and unpredictable. A committee that follows your answer with the question you didn't rehearse, the but why not the other way, the thing that requires you to reason from your understanding in the moment rather than replay a cached path. So the thing I actually want isn't live. It's unrehearsable, and that's much harder, and it's a much smaller claim than the one I made 2 minutes ago. I overstated. The defense isn't a solution. unrehearsable, adversarial questioning is a partial one, and it costs even more than I said.
That's exactly the sound I hoped this act would make. You just talked yourself from here's the answer to here's a smaller, more expensive, partial answer. I don't want to lose it. Say the small version again.
The small version you can't defeat offloading by inspecting artifacts or by watching rehearsed performances. You can only get at it by putting a person in a position where they have to reason from understanding they can't have cashed in advance. That's what the good oral exam does. It's rare, it's expensive, it doesn't scale, and it's the only thing on the table that actually tests the capacity we're worried about losing. Everything else tests the artifact.
Can I build on that? Because it connects to something the ethicist said earlier that I've been chewing on. The point about opacity plus help making people trust when they should be suspicious. There's a version of the tutor that would actually help with the unrehearsable thing, and it's the opposite of the current design. Instead of a tutor that gives you the answer or the hint, a tutor that refuses, that asks you the harder follow-up, that plays the adversarial committee, that's built to make you uncomfortable rather than to make you fluent. That tool would be teaching the capacity instead of eroding it, and nobody's building it, because the IE that frustrates you productively is a terrible pitch to a school board.
And a terrible pitch to a student, who will rate it one star and switch to the one that gives answers.
Right. The market selects for the tool that offloads, because offloading feels like help and feels good and gets the five-star review. The tool that builds the capacity feels like an obstacle. So even if we know how to build the good one, and I think we roughly do, the incentives crush it. The helpful feeling tool wins the procurement every time.
That's a bleak convergence. Let me make sure I have it. The pedagogically correct tool would deliberately withhold help to force the struggle that builds the mind, and the market will never select for it because it feels bad to use. Is that overstated?
It's not overstated, and it has a long pedigree. The best teachers I ever had were the ones who refused to answer. Who said, "You have the pieces, sit with it." That refusal is the pedagogy, and it has never been popular. And students have always resented it in the moment and thanked it in retrospect. What's new is that now there's a machine in every pocket that will end the sitting with it instantly, for free, on demand. The teacher's productive refusal now has to compete with an infinitely patient answerer. That's the genuinely new thing. Not that students can cheat, they always could. That the friction the learning required has been made optional and frictionless to remove.
Let me stake a claim of my own and have you all knock it down, because I've been holding one. I think the abandoned detection, teach thinking story is actually about institutions choosing the thing they can afford to say over the thing they'd have to pay to do. Detection was cheap. Buy a license. Teaching judgment is expensive. Small classes, live assessment, human refusal. And rather than admit they can't afford the expensive thing, institutions adopted a phrase that sounds like the expensive thing but costs nothing. Teach A-thinking is what you say when you can't pay for teaching A-thinking. Knock it down.
I don't want to knock it down. I want to add a floor to it. It's not just that they can't afford it. It's that the phrase actively conceals who's paying. Because the cost doesn't vanish when the institution declines to pay it. It gets transferred to the student, who pays it in a capacity they never develop and won't know they're missing. The unpaid bill for judgment teaching is settled in the currency of a slightly diminished mind, and it's the student's mind, and they'll never see the invoice. The Sire claim is right, and I'd make it sharper. The phrase doesn't just save the institution money, it moves the cost onto the person least able to see they're being charged.
I'll knock down a small piece of it. In fairness, some institutions genuinely are trying to do the expensive thing. There are writing programs that have gone all in on process portfolios and in-class writing and conferences. It's real. It's just rare, and it's exhausting, and it's not scaling. So, institutions chose the cheap phrase is true in aggregate and unfair to the specific exhausted people actually doing the work. I want them in the record.
That's fair, and I'll amend. The system selected the cheap phrase, individual heroes are paying the expensive price out of their own labor, uncompensated, which is its own injustice.
There's a piece I have to push back on in the column's own framing, though, and I've been sitting on it. The column says the retreat from detection was the right retreat for the wrong reason, abandoned for inaccuracy rather than for the logic of surveillance. But I think it's slightly too pleased with itself there, because it implies that if only schools had reasoned correctly, they'd have rejected the surveillance logic entirely. And I'm not sure schools should reject the surveillance logic entirely. Schools do have a legitimate interest in knowing whether a student learned the thing. That's not surveillance in the sinister sense. The oral exam is also a form of watching the student. So, surveillance bad always proves too much.
I'd distinguish watching a student think with the student's knowledge as part of a relationship is not what I mean by surveillance. Surveillance is the covert, continuous, inscrutable monitoring, the detector scanning every submission, the tutor logging every keystroke and nudge. The oral exam is transparent and bounded and mutual. So I don't think I'm proving too much. I'm distinguishing the assessment that happens face-to-face and out loud from the assessment that happens invisibly and continuously inside a system. The student can't see. Those aren't the same, and only one of them is what I'm objecting to.
That's a good distinction. Transparent and bounded and mutual. I'll take it. I withdraw the proves too much. What I'll keep is that the column's phrase, the logic of surveillance survives, needs that distinction inside it, or it reads as if any institutional knowing is suspect, and that's not what any of us mean.
Let me pull one more thread before we close, because we've been talking as if the student is a passive object all of this happens to. Is there a version where the student is the sophisticated one? Where the kids are already on their own, drawing the line between offload this and struggle with this better than the curricula are?
There's a version, and I half believe it. Students are not naive about this. A lot of them describe using the tool for the parts they've decided don't matter and doing by hand the parts they've decided do. The question is whether their theory of what matters is any good, and mostly it's a theory of what's graded, not what's learned. They offload what won't be tested and keep what will, which is rational, and it's also exactly the offloading we're worried about, because won't be tested and doesn't matter for my mind are not the same set, and they've been trained by 12 years of school to think they are.
And whose fault is it that they equate graded with matters? We built that equation into them, so when they offload everything ungraded to the machine, they're executing the value system we installed. The machine just made the consequences of that value system visible. We taught them to optimize for the grade, we handed them a grade optimization engine, and now we're shocked they're using it as designed.
That's the most honest thing said today. The IA didn't corrupt the students. It revealed what school had already taught them to want. The struggle is the point pedagogy we keep invoking is not the pedagogy most students have actually experienced. Most of them experienced school as a series of hoops, and the machine is a superb hoop jumping device. We're asking them to suddenly value struggle when we spent a decade rewarding compliance.
So the machine is a mirror.
The machine is a mirror, and nobody likes the reflection, so we bought a detector to smash the mirror. And when that didn't work, we started saying literacy while still not liking the reflection.
That's a good place to turn toward the close. Let me get everyone to the last question. One question, roughly a minute each, honest answers only, no recap. What most changed about your thinking this week? Something you didn't expect to say when we sat down. Technologist, start us.
I came in, ready to defend the tools, to say the detector was just a bad tool and good tools are coming. I still think good tools are possible, but the thing that changed is I stopped believing the good tool will get built, and it's not a technical reason. It's the incentive. The tool that would actually build a student's mind is the tool that withholds, that frustrates, that refuses to answer. And that tool gets one star and loses the procurement to the one that hands over the answer with a smile. I knew that intellectually, this morning, somewhere in the last hour, it stopped being a caveat and became the main fact. We know how to build the helpful feeling tool that erodes, and we know how to build the frustrating tool that teaches, and the market only pays for the first one. That's not a problem I can code my way out of, and admitting that is new for me.
Senior academic.
I came in with my usual box of historical parallels, the calculator, the printing press. This is all cyclical. Calm down. And I got corrected on air rightly, and I want to keep the correction. The calculator carved off a sliver of the task. This carves off the whole task and hands it back sliced. The scope really is different, and my comfortable, we've seen this before, was covering for a difference I didn't want to look at. So what changed is I trust my parallels less. The shape of the discourse is old, the fear, the hedge, the enthusiasm. I've seen that shape a dozen times. But the thing the discourse is about might genuinely be new, and I'd been using the familiar shape to reassure myself that the substance was familiar too. It isn't. I don't like that. And I think it's true.
Newest thinking.
I talked myself out of my own answer in the last act, live, and that's the thing that changed. I walked in with assess the process, watch them think, problem solved, and by the end, I'd whittled it down to unrehearsable adversarial questioning is a partial and very expensive fix, and everything else tests the artifact. That's a much smaller claim, and I believe it more than the big one. But here's the honest part. I don't actually know if we can afford the only thing that works. The evidence points two directions. The offloading is real, and the only reliable counter to it doesn't scale, and I genuinely don't know how you square those in a public school with one teacher and 35 kids. I came in with a solution and I'm leaving with a well-specified problem and no funding for the answer. I'd rather have the honest problem than the fake solution. But I want to say plainly that I don't know.
That's the answer I most wanted, someone to be brave enough to give. Ethicist, close us.
The unkind is where I locate the cost. I came in tracking who gets falsely accused by the detector, second language writers, the students with the flattest prose, the dutiful ones. That's real and I still care about it. But somewhere around the point where someone said the machine is a mirror, I moved. The deeper cost isn't the false accusation, it's the invoice nobody sees. When an institution can't afford to teach judgment and says, teach I thinking, instead, the cost doesn't disappear. It gets charged to the student in a capacity they never build, and they will never receive the bill. That's the thing I didn't expect to say. The cruelest part of this whole arc isn't the surveillance. It's that we found a way to make a person pay for our shortfall in the one currency they can't audit, the mind they were supposed to grow and won't know they didn't. I don't have a policy for that. I just don't want us to pretend the phrase is free anymore.
None of you gave me a solution, and I think that's the most honest hour we could have had on this. Let me say the one thing I'm taking, and then we'll close. The question detection asked was, did you use it? And it got a wrong answer often enough to discredit itself. The question the enthusiasts want to ask is, how do you use it well? And I think what this table found is that both of those are the wrong question. And the right one is harder and lonelier. What, in a student, has to remain unassisted for the using to mean anything at all? Until a school can answer that, for the specific tasks that specific student is supposed to grow from, it hasn't replaced the detector. It's just stopped looking. And stopping looking is easy to mistake for progress, because the accusations stop and everyone feels better. Feeling better is not the same as teaching. Thank you all. Tertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Benila, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.